We're getting the latest on the pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The White House COVID-19 response team held a briefing this week about the CDC's new mask guidelines for people who have been fully vaccinated. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, said people who have been fully vaccinated against COVID can now spend time together indoors and unmasked.
Remember, here we are talking about private settings where everyone is vaccinated. So what does this mean? If you and a friend or you and a family member are both vaccinated, you can have dinner together wearing masks without distancing. You can visit your grandparents if you have been vaccinated and they have been too.
Have you been fully vaccinated and are making plans to see family? Share with us. What questions do you have about virus variants, mask wearing, or what the future holds for vaccinating our youth? 800-642-1234. Caroline Chen is a healthcare reporter at ProPublica. Caroline, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, it's so nice to be back on your show.
Well, let's start with the CDC's new guidelines. Dr. Walensky, their head of the CDC, laying it out for us. Can you explain what this means? Explain it for us.
Yeah, so as of this morning, according to CDC data, we now have 18.8% of the population thereabout has at least one dose of a vaccine. And about 9.9, so just nearly 10% of the population is fully vaccinated. So we're really starting to see, you know, meaningful numbers of people who have the vaccination now. And so, you know, the CDC came out with guidance about what you can do when you've been fully vaccinated and what that really means. And so, you played a clip of Dr. Walensky talking about people who have been fully vaccinated with other people who have been fully vaccinated, being able to sort of gather indoors with them without masks. Basically, you know, life sort of almost goes back to normal, basically goes back to normal for people who have been totally vaccinated. And then they also laid out some steps for people who have been fully vaccinated with people who have not yet been vaccinated. And you know, you can go on the CDC's websites for more details there, but they basically sort of said, you know, in that case, they would encourage you to stick to sort of one other household if that other household is low risk. So in this case, for example, if a grandparent has been vaccinated, they can go visit their grandchildren, but stick to that one other family that has not yet been vaccinated. And so this is all part of the process of vaccines helping us return to normal slowly, and really shows the power of vaccines.
Does this new guidance, though, complicate mask wearing, which has become such a polarizing issue in our nation?
I don't know. You know, when you say complicate, I think, you know, masks have been sort of this a temporary tool that we have known so far scientifically has been very effective at lowering the rates of transmission, but are not going to be as effective as vaccines in terms of, you know, really being able to bring the pandemic to an end and sort of really change the curve permanently. Unless we all, you know, every single one of us wear masks sort of with perfect compliance, which we know that we just haven't been able to do in the U.S. Vaccines sort of have a much longer staying power in that they can actually teach your immune system to recognize the virus. So I think what vaccines do is they sort of come in and sort of slowly let people who are fully vaccinated start to be able to take off the masks around each other. As this is the CDC's guidance. Now, I know that there's some actual still conversation around this with regards to, you know, can, you know, when you've been vaccinated, you know, is it, you know, some people say, you know, even if I'm vaccinated, I still want to keep a mask on to sort of, you know, encourage other people who have not yet been vaccinated, since it's still 90% of the population, to keep wearing their mask. So when I'm out in public, you know, even if I'm vaccinated, I'm going to still wear a mask. And a lot of public health experts still advocate for that. But I think what the CDC is saying is, like, if you're a fully vaccinated person and you're with another fully vaccinated person indoors together, then you can take off your masks.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with ProPublica reporter Caroline Shin about how Americans are assessing the COVID-19 vaccine, the new guidance from the CDC. With your questions as well, have you been fully vaccinated? What has your experience been like? Are you hopeful that this will be a turning point in the pandemic? 800-642-1234. Saul is with us in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good morning. One of the problems with this, and the CDC is at fault, and that is when a person says, I've been vaccinated, that means they got an injection of vaccine. It does not mean that they are immunized. And so in those CDC directions, buried a couple paragraphs down, it says 2 weeks after the last shot. That should be emphasized in every single news story. 2 weeks to give the shot a chance to reach maximum immune effectiveness.
Saul, thank you for pointing that out. Caroline, you know, that 2 week waiting period, and is this regardless whether you get the one dose Johnson & Johnson or a two dose vaccine?
Yeah, so I do want to thank Saul for pointing that out. And, you know, we've sort of been using a shorthand here of fully vaccinated. And so I think we should clarify that for all listeners here. When we say fully vaccinated, that does mean 2 weeks after either the second dose of a two-dose series, which means the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, or 2 weeks after your single-dose vaccine, which would be the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
The new guidelines issued this week don't include an update on travel. The CDC currently says delay travel and stay home. You know, we are getting to that point in time, though, where it is spring break travel season. How is the, you know, how should you negotiate travel recommendations and what might be forecast there?
Yeah, so the CDC did get some questions about that, and their answer was generally just that they're still just concerned about travel because anytime they see a spike in travel, they see a spike in cases. Now, I think a lot of people, you know, scientifically, you could argue, you know, if you're fully vaccinated, given the data, particularly that's starting to come out of places like Israel around, you know, what it means for transmission, that, you know, people who are fully vaccinated should not be able really, like, the chances of them being able to transmit are very low. But I understand that the CDC is being probably pretty conservative on this side here because they don't want to send any sort of signal that's like, you know, everybody go travel, you know, especially when vaccination rates are still relatively low. It's still about 10% who are fully vaccinated right now. You know, to send the signal to people that, like, you know, go ahead, go travel right now. I think they just don't want to undo any of the work that has led to cases being lowered right now. However, I think the other thing that I appreciated Dr. Walensky saying right at the very start of her briefing was that these are initial guidelines and that as, you know, more data comes in and as the vaccination rollout continues, that they're going to be updating these guidelines. And I think that that posture of, you know, as the science changes, as we get more data, we will also evolve. I understand that that can be sometimes a little bit unsatisfying to the public who just want, like, you know, give it to me in black and white. Mm-hmm. But this is how science is, especially, you know, when we're dealing with a new virus, with new vaccines, and with a dynamic situation where, you know, we are rolling out new vaccines and scientists are sort of actively gathering data to make sure, like, you know, are these vaccines actually really truly bending the curve? Can we really prove that they are lowering transmission rates? And as we gather this data to then sort of respond and update the guidelines, I think that that is probably wise. And just to hear her say, you know, these are initial guidelines, they may change, I kind of would rather hear the CDC say that than to hear them say, this is it. And then,
A
month later, have them be like, well, actually, we're changing it. And then sort of give us all whiplash.
Caroline Chin covers public health at ProPublica and the developments on this COVID crisis. What questions do you have about variants, about spread? Are you wearing two masks to protect against COVID? What questions do you have about doubling up? Have you been fully vaccinated? What can you say about that? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Caroline Chin here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing COVID developments with your questions front and center here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Next door, Minnesota is expanding vaccine access to nearly a third of its population. Alaska became the first state to open vaccine access to everyone 16 and up. At home here in Wisconsin, more than 1.1 million people have received at least one dose. Are you eligible to get the vaccine but have concerns about what you've heard about it? Have you seen other states administer vaccines in different ways that you want Wisconsin to adopt? Are you working to improve access in underserved communities? Share your story, your insights, questions, 800-642-1234. ProPublica healthcare reporter Caroline Chin is with us. Kim is joining us now from Marshfield with a situation. Kim, hi, what would you like to share?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am going to visit my mother, who is 91, this weekend. I haven't seen her for a year and it's her birthday, actually, this weekend. So anyhow, I have been fully vaccinated. It's been a month since my second vaccine. She had COVID back in October. She's just got her first vaccine yesterday, so it'll only be two days since her vaccine that I'll be visiting her. So what sort of precautions or what should I do in that situation as far as visiting with her?
Oh, Kim, thank you. Caroline.
Well, first of all, Kim, happy birthday to your mom. That's awesome. I mean, I think in this particular case, you know, I will caveat by saying that I am not an epidemiologist here or a doctor, but I think, given that your mom is not fully vaccinated, which means that she is not, 2 weeks past her second dose, and she's elderly, which means that she's still sort of in an increased risk situation. You know, probably being outdoors would make a big difference. If that's possible, being sort of in a well-ventilated area, sort of still treating her as someone who is still at risk. You know, the data does show that one shot of the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccine does already start to offer protection. You know, that has been shown in the data, but I think if you were to act sort of more conservatively, you know, just to be on the safe side, still treating her as at risk, sort of, you know, better to be safe than sorry. And, you know, I think that, you know, all the things we already know, which is like, you know, having good ventilation, sticking to being outdoors, all of that makes a good difference. But I think particularly the fact that you are fully vaccinated can give you a lot more peace of mind.
Kim, all the best to you on that reunion. Thanks for calling in. Sandy now in Walworth. Hi, Sandy. What would you like to add?
Hi. Yeah, I just would like to say, because I do listen to public radio and I've heard lots of different stories on this topic. The vaccines do not make you immune. And I'd love to hear that talked about more, that you're not immune from the disease. You can still actually still transfer the virus from, get it from someone and transfer it to another person. But the, so you've got that, but also the, like I say, it's not, you're not immune. You simply, it protects you from getting seriously sick. These are things that I've heard over time on public radio. So I would just love to hear that.
That piece of it. Yeah. Sandy, thank you.
Yeah, Sandy. So this is something that I'm going to try to break down quickly. But, you know, obviously what Sandy is bringing up here is a pretty complicated and important topic. So what does the data actually show? So when Pfizer and Moderna's adult trials were initially run, what they were able to show, which is what's called the primary endpoint of the study, is that they were able to prevent, as she said, severe disease. So it really stopped people from getting sick and being hospitalized. So that is something that all three vaccines clearly are able to do. And that's fantastic, right? And that's the easiest thing for studies to measure, you know, the rates of hospitalization. The question then of, does it prevent transmission? So when you have the vaccine, can you still pick up the virus and transmit it to somebody else? Is a much harder thing for a study to measure. But there is some preliminary data. This is what I mentioned earlier, the studies from Israel. And there are a number of studies from Israel now, which are starting to give some evidence that the vaccine can lower transmission. And they've done this by measuring viral loads in people who have been vaccinated. Now, is this a slam dunk 100%? You know, we are 100% confident that it means that you can never transmit the virus. I don't think we're at that stage yet, but I think we're starting to be in a position where there is, I would say, some evidence that the vaccines can help to lower transmission. I realize that this is in a somewhat squishy space, not super, super satisfying, but I would say that this is the sort of evidence that is satisfying to epidemiologists and public health officials at a population level, which means the more people that get vaccinated, the better this is for the whole pandemic, because en masse, we're probably going to be able to lower transmission. Does this mean that you as an individual who is vaccinated can say with 100% confidence, black and white, I will never be able to like pick up the virus and then transmit it to somebody else? I don't think we're at that stage of confidence to be able to say that. But I think this is the tricky thing with any vaccine conversation, is that there's sort of a level that we talk on at an individual, like, what can I say about myself? And then there's a level that we talk about, which is what studies show sort of en masse as a group, like, what is this doing for whole populations? Is this lowering transmission as a whole? Is this going to be able to turn the curve of the pandemic as a whole? And I think that's where sort of we can see the power of vaccines at scale. And that's sort of where we're at right now with the question of what does it do for transmission?
Caroline Chen has been reporting on the intricate production of the COVID vaccines for ProPublica and the developments on COVID in this pandemic. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Caroline, what about vaccines and the variants that are popping up, the more contagious variants? How are the vaccines responding?
Yeah, so I think there was a lot of concern about particularly B.1.1.7, which is the variant that was first identified in the UK, especially when some cases were identified in the US. So the good news is that the vaccines that are on the market right now, none of them are totally inefficient against the variants that are you know, identified right now. Some of the vaccines that are on the market have been shown to be slightly less effective against, you know, some of the variants like the P1 variant or B1351, which is the variants found first identified in South Africa and Brazil, but they still work to some degree. So the big takeaways here for me are, one, get vaccinated when you get the chance to get vaccinated, because for now, the vaccines that we have are effective, at least to some degree, against the variants that are out there. And two, all of our individual jobs is to not be a case. And the reason why I say that is because the way the virus works is that sort of as it goes along, multiplying, it just naturally mutates spontaneously.
That's what they do.
Mutation happens. Mutation happens. Not even intentionally. I mean, the virus doesn't have any intent here. It's just in the process of copying itself, sometimes it makes mistakes and that becomes a mutation. So every new case is sort of a new opportunity for the virus to make a mistake in copying itself. And every potential mistake is a potential new variant. Mm. And so we don't want to give the virus more opportunities to mutate and more opportunities thus to become a new variant that would be a variant of concern. And so I see my job as an individual is to just like not be another opportunity to become a variant.
Caroline Chen stays with us as we look at potential for COVID-19 immunization for kids. We'll be talking about that and why many pediatricians say the sooner the better. Are you hoping to see approval for children immunization soon? Are your children going back to the classroom for learning or staying virtual? What do you want to know about the virus spread through kids and what the data is saying? Be part of this 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Caroline Chen after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the latest guidance on the COVID pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Federal health officials this week relaxed guidelines for seeing nursing home residents in person. The joint statement from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the CDC says, quote, facilities should allow responsible indoor visitation at all times and for all residents, regardless of vaccination status of the resident or visitor, unless certain scenarios arise, end quote. Are you planning to visit a loved one in a nursing home? What questions do you have about mask wearing and the path to herd immunity? 800-642-1234. We have ProPublica's Caroline Chen, who's with us for the hour. Mike from Bruce has a question. Hi, Mike. What is your situation?
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm fully vaccinated, and my daughter, who's also fully vaccinated, has invited me to meet her down in Florida because none of her friends her age are vaccinated. It's just the way it's worked out. But anyway, so I'm going to spend a few days down there. And my question is, when I get back, my wife, who's not fully vaccinated, she's had her first shot just a couple of days ago. What type of precautions do I need to take? She wants to know if I have to sleep upstairs for a few days and stay masked.
Mike, yeah, thank you for sharing that and for the ability there to be able to meet up with your daughter. Caroline, what would you advise?
I think this is a little beyond the scope. I'm a little hesitant here because I'm not a doctor. Mm-hmm. I would ask your primary care doctor what they would advise. If your wife is not high risk and she's had her first shot, you know, I wonder if this would fall under the CDC's guidelines of sort of one household, quote unquote, one household, which happens to be your own household. Mm-hmm. You're visiting of a person who is not fully vaccinated, and thus, you know, you wouldn't really need to do anything. That would be sort of my perhaps interpretation of the CDC's guidelines. But since there's also the element of travel there, I would maybe perhaps, check in with your physician to see if they would interpret that the same way.
Let's turn to the topic of kids. You've talked with Dr. Anthony Fauci about the possibility of COVID-19 vaccines for children. Dr. Fauci, who has been a really prominent medical and scientific force in the pandemic, what is the status of the trials?
Yeah, so I would first start by reminding listeners of where we are with eligibility, which is 16 and up is what's been authorized for at least Pfizer and I think Moderna's vaccines. And then I would then split kids into sort of two buckets. So one is teens, so the 12 to 15s, and then younger children. And there's sort of different stories happening for those two groups. The teens trials are well underway. Pfizer has already finished enrolling its teenage trial, and they told me that they would have data in the first half of 2021. And Moderna has already started enrolling its trial. I don't think they finished enrolling its trial, but, you know, they are hopeful to have data this year as well. And then depending on how that goes, both companies will then move into younger children.
You've also reached out to pediatricians on this. What have they been telling you?
Yeah, so I think, you know, what's really important for everyone, every pediatrician that I've talked to, is that they said that they really want to see data in kids. So you can't just say, you know, it looked good in adults, therefore, you know, go ahead and extend authorization into teens and into younger children based on the adult data. That's not going to fly for any pediatrician. Like, mm-hmm. they need to see the data, both for safety and efficacy. Really, really important to get safety data in children before they're going to recommend it. But then I said, you know, if the data looked exactly like you wanted it to look, like super safe, no side effects that you're worried about, and it worked, would you then recommend the vaccine for kids? Particularly since, you know, we've been really lucky so far that COVID has really not been serious for kids. You know, it's really impacted the elderly most. Would you still recommend the vaccine for kids? And every pediatrician I talked to said, yes, we would recommend it for every kid. And they kind of had two reasons. Like, one, on an individual level, they said there are, you know, even though it's rare, some very serious cases of what's called multi-inflammatory system MISC in children, which can be very serious, in some very rare cases can be fatal. And that's still not super well understood. So you still want to, you know, protect children from that potential. And number two is thinking more on a population level, is that even though right now the evidence is pointing towards especially younger children transmitting at lower rates than adults, it's not that they cannot transmit. They definitely can transmit. And so as we, you know, as everyone as a population tries to curb the pandemic and stop transmission, you know, children as a whole take up 20% of the population. And so we all want to, you know, stop transmission. Again, as we talked about earlier on, nobody wants to be a case because we don't want to offer the virus more chances to mutate and potentially become a variant. And so for those sort of population health reasons, they also would encourage everybody who has a chance to get the vaccine. But again, first we got to get the data and make sure that it is totally safe and effective.
And you talk here about bending that curve. And as we try to go toward herd immunity, can we reach herd immunity without immunizing children?
I think, you know, just mathematically, I think that is probably not possible. Mm. But I think that there is another thing that I've started hearing, you know, in discussions with scientists, which is, you know, there is a chance that the COVID will become what's called endemic, which is like the flu. It's just going to be around. But if we can turn it into something that is not that deadly, you know, which is if you get it, it's basically going to be like a cold. That is also a great outcome for us. And that is something that the vaccines are possibly and already going to be helping us do, because we already know that for adults, the data has shown that with the vaccines, if you get it, it's really going to lower your chances of being hospitalized and having severe disease. So it's already changing the profile of what it looks like if you get COVID.
We're talking with ProPublica reporter Caroline Chen. She's with us, and we've been looking into the vaccine clinical trials in kids, getting at your questions about the pandemic. Do you work in public health? What concerns do you have about variants or about how you're spreading information about fighting this pandemic? And what do you want to see Wisconsin do in terms of administering vaccines? 800-642-1234. Caroline, as you look at how vaccines are administered around the country, what are your takeaways? What are states doing here that we should look up as maybe models to try to emulate? Or what are you seeing in this rollout?
You know, I think initially there were a lot of, you know, bumps in the road as people try to figure out the new vaccines and, you know, particularly some cold storage requirements. And now we're starting to see a lot of states hit sort of a more steady pace. However, you know, I have been reporting with my colleague, Maryam Jamil, lately on some systemic barriers that are still being, you know, probably unintentionally designed into systems which can still affect some of the really vulnerable populations who really do need the vaccines. And this is preventing there being equitable distribution. And so these can be things like, you know, not having ways for people who are disabled to get to the vaccine so they can make an appointment, but then they have no way of getting there if they don't have transportation. Another example that we ran across was, for example, you know, Los Angeles Dodger Stadium is a huge mass vaccination site. I'm sure everybody's seen images of that on TV. LA's Chinatown is right next door to it. But a lot of their residents don't have cars, and Dodger Stadium is drive-through only. So, you know, they literally are less than like a mile away from Dodger Stadium, and they can't go there to get their vaccinations. So if they don't, you know, now finally LA County is starting to talk about sending mobile vaccination sites towards Chinatown. But this was, you know, what I've realized is there's so many small local advocacy organizations that are needing to do this work to make sure that these communities are not forgotten, because otherwise a lot of these sort of mass vaccination sites are sort of easy for people who are super motivated, who are very tech savvy, who have the means to get themselves to places, who have time to go, you know, who maybe are able to go on weekends or on odd hours. And then for folks who maybe are not internet savvy, who don't have a car, it's much, much harder for them to get to a vaccine. And so I think that there are still, in many cases, obstacles that need to be removed so that everybody can get a vaccine.
As you said there, you know, many signups to get on the schedule to get a vaccine, that requires you to have internet access. It requires you to be able to go to a website and sign up for that. And that might not be possible.
Yeah. And I've heard some really heartwarming stories of, you know, people across the internet helping other people sign up for vaccines. You know, I've heard of, you know, various reporters at different newspapers who take calls from people in their community and help them sign up. But that also then makes me think this should not be necessary. And what if there are people in the community who don't have a grandchild or a daughter or think to call, you know, a friendly reporter who will go out of their way for them to help them sign up. And I worry for those people who aren't connected.
We have Caroline Chen with us. She's a healthcare reporter at ProPublica. The pace of vaccines in our country continues to accelerate. Are you next in line? Do you have questions about efficacy or the one dose Johnson & Johnson versus the two shot dosage from Pfizer and Moderna? Are you worried that our nation will loosen restrictions too quickly? What risks are you willing to take? Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Caroline Chen here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with healthcare reporter Caroline Chen of ProPublica. A year into the pandemic, we're taking stock of lessons learned and focusing on your questions that revolve around the pandemic in family and community. Caroline Chen, she's fielding questions for about 10 more minutes. We've seen states loosening restrictions around indoor dining, around gatherings. What data are they using to make those decisions? And what should we know about indoor dining at this point?
I don't know what data states are using really, you know, state to state, because I think state to state, it's really an individual decision. Mm-hmm. I really hope they are using data to make that decision, as opposed to, you know, mostly using, you know, I understand that governors are under a lot of pressure, you know, politically and economically all the time. And I can't imagine doing that job, but I do hope that it is a science-based decision always. I think that, you know, generally speaking, what we all know by now is that, particularly being indoors where there's poor ventilation, if there's poor ventilation, you know, those, and there are crowds, that's sort of the conditions that the virus likes the most. So I think, you know, without masks, indoor dining can, if it's poorly ventilated, be a particularly sort of virus happy condition. But I think a lot of this depends case by case on, you know, the specific dining conditions. But also, I think one of the things that was pointed out to me when I was reporting on this and talking to a lot of epidemiologists is that if you're looking just at case count data and seeing that come down and using that as your metric, that may not be enough. The other thing that a lot of epidemiologists have been worried about is variants, which we talked about earlier on, and making sure that your state has good surveillance on variants. And that is pretty patchy across the US. The CDC has, since November this year, really started to ramp up on that. But, you know, the US as a whole is pretty far, far behind other countries like the UK. So the UK sequences about 8 to 10% of all of its positive cases. The US sequences under 1% of all of its positive cases. So that just gives you a sense of, you know, how much less visibility we have. And so what, the fear is,
yeah, why is more surveillance necessary? Why should we be sequencing these samples?
So the idea here is just to not let a variant sneak up on you, because you, something like B117 is thought to be about 50% more transmissible than sort of the regular, what they call wild type coronavirus. So you could be seeing cases come down, say from a holiday peak or something like that, but then you have B117, if it's just come into your state, sort of be sneaking up. And because it's more transmissible, it could be accelerating sort of under your nose without you knowing if you're not sequencing cases. And then if right at that point you decide to open up, say indoor dining or sort of removing mitigation measures, that could be an unwise move right at that point. On the other hand, if you have really good surveillance and you're able to see, you know, we don't have a lot of variant cases, or you have really good contact tracing, so any case you have, any cluster you have or outbreak, you're able to sequence them and say, you know, these are all just sort of regular coronavirus, we don't have any variants here, then a governor is able to act with more confidence to say, you know, we can continue to loosen mitigation measures because cases are coming down. And we know that this is sort of, this is a real signal here, quote unquote, that we're not missing any potential fear that a variant might be creeping up under us without us knowing.
So yeah, that more detective work can always, you know, help in making more informed decisions about what the next step to make sure you don't giving the virus any openings. Jeff is joining us now from Waukesha with a question. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. My question is, has anybody seen proven information on flying that the airlines are really disinfecting their planes somehow? I don't know how they could do it in between flights, and is, you know, is flying generally considered safe now, or safe as possible, or what?
Jeff, thank you. On the state of airline travel and on those flights, Caroline.
Oh, Jeff, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to disappoint you here because I don't have, you know, I haven't done reporting on this, and I don't have good data on, you know, what would be, what would be the bar of safe enough? You know, I think really for myself personally right now, I think I haven't had an opportunity to get on a plane. So I haven't looked into this. I do know that, you know, there have been some case studies that have shown that unfortunately, even in brief moments where passengers have, there have been passengers that have that were infected on planes, even when all of them got on and were masked, that transmission occurred, and they thought that maybe it was when they went to the bathroom and took off their masks, and that there might have been some transmission that happened then between a couple of passengers. So it does seem that, you know, it's not, it might be a rare event, but it can happen. And you can, if you're interested in those studies, you can just look up like case studies, COVID transmission on planes. So I think this might be one of those situations where, you know, waiting to be fully vaccinated would give you the most peace of mind. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say right now. I'm sorry I don't have more data on hand about exactly what the what the airlines are doing.
We're talking with Caroline Chen, who has been reporting on the coronavirus, the spread, the variants, the risks to public health. You can join in 800-642-1234. Caroline, in recent months, there have been double masking going on. What have you learned about people wearing double masks? What does that do?
Yeah, so actually, the CDC's guidance around double masking really comes from their studies on proper fitted masks.
Okay.
And what they found basically is that having a mask that fits well to your face can make a significant difference. And so however you get that properly fitted mask, whether it is having, a higher quality mask, or double masking, by having, for example, like a surgical mask under a cloth mask, which sort of gives you a tighter fit. It's not so much, however many layers or whatever the material is, it's that by double masking, you get a better fit over your face so that you don't have as many gaps. That's what's giving you the additional protection.
Dave is joining us from Lake Geneva, asking about variants. Dave, hi. Mm-hmm.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We've been hearing for a while about the variants being more easily transmissible. I have not seen any information about how that occurs. Does it stay viable on a surface longer? Does it require a smaller viral load to be transmitted? Does it stay in the air longer? How should we be changing our behavior to protect ourselves from the variants?
You are asking such a good question here, and the answer is I don't know yet, and I know some scientists who are working on these questions, but I have not seen any papers published yet. And I think that is, of course, if we knew that answer, as you say, there could potentially be some mitigation consequences. As you said, if we really understood the biological factors of what's making it more transmissible. But for now, I think that there has been no change in recommendation for how we behave, which is, stay masked, social distance, wash your hands. As far as the conversations I've had with epidemiologists go, they have had no change in their recommendations for, how we should behave to protect ourselves from variants. But really having more understanding is something that I know a lot of scientists are interested in and are working on.
Caroline, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Caroline Chen is a healthcare reporter at ProPublica. She's currently reporting on the pandemic. If you missed any part of this, you can stream the full discussion at WPR.org/mornings. And on Monday, we tackle more of your COVID-specific questions with an infectious disease physician at our side. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.